Boker Tov, everybody. A pleasure to see so many people bright and early as we welcome Dr. Aaron Kohler back to Torah in Motion to begin a 6-part series on Megillat Esther. We have a long time of Misha Nichnas Adar Marvin B'Simcha. Simcha is another Aleph and another Beit, and really it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Kohler, who is a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Yeshiva University, where he's chair of the Barron Department of Jewish Studies. He's author of Unbinding Isaac, The Significance of the Akedah for Jewish Thought, and more relevant to this particular class is Esther and Ancient Jewish Thought, published by Cambridge University Press. Among other articles and books that he has written, he served as a visiting professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, research fellowships, the Albright Institute for Archaeological Research, and the Hartman Institute. And it's a pleasure. He lives in Queens with his wife, Shira Kohler, we've had the pleasure of working with also in the past. And a pleasure to welcome him back to Torah Motion. And Mavakasha, Dr. Kohler, it's all yours.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. We're not going to do that every week, are we?
No. Just the first time. No. I'm sorry if I, you know.
No, that's fine. Thank you. One time we can tolerate.
One time. Yes. Yeah. And if you do like, you know, a 50 part series, then it's only once in 50 weeks, you know, at the
point. Got it. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's good to be here, wherever here is exactly. I'm excited for this class as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, I wrote about Esther, but I wrote that book came out 8 years ago already. So it's a topic that I spent a lot of time on then, and then sort of come back to from a number of angles, but haven't really been living with in the same intensive way over the last few years. So it's nice to have a chance to revisit it, rethink about some of the things. I see at least two people on the Zoom who I know have actually written books on Esther. I see Sandra Rappaport and Epi, who has apparently a more formal name. But so I've had a chance to learn from your work, and hopefully this will be a mutual learning experience. What I'm going to do is as follows. I'm not going to try to teach something new about the book of Esther. Certainly not today. Instead, what I'm going to do today to set up the time that we have for the next few weeks is to offer a reading of the book of Esther that is as radical a reading as possible. Now, I know different people would think of different kinds of readings as being radical. So you'll see soon what I mean by that. But I want to be clear about what I am and I'm not doing here. So I'm not actually going to be arguing today that this is the correct reading of the book of Esther. I just want to argue that it's a reasonable reading of the book of Esther, because what we're actually going to be spending most of our time on in the coming weeks is how other readers responded to the book of Esther, starting almost immediately upon its quote unquote publication. So it's a book that has caused trouble for readers, for Jewish readers throughout the ages. So the last 2,400 years or so, we can only document about 2,200 years of those responses, but it's been causing trouble for a very long time. If you don't think it causes trouble, and as if you're like, what do you mean? It's a great book. I don't see what the issue is. Then that's because someone's already solved these problems for you. So what I'd like to do today is to set out one reading that, I know, and we'll see in coming weeks, some people did think was the meaning of the book of Esther. But even if it's not the correct reading, it's one way that the book could have been read. And that meant that it was a problem. So with that background, so in other words, here's a good question. Here's a bad question for today. If you say, well, that's not what I think it means, not a good question for today. It might not be what the book means. Maybe not. Maybe we'll come back to it. I'll ask you later on over the course of the coming weeks. Maybe we'll think about why you think it means something different. But if you say like, well, that's not even a reasonable reading, like no one could think that, and that's a relevant objection to something we'll be looking at today. Okay, so I'm going to put a bunch of things up a PowerPoint, not a very fancy one, but I put it up anyway. There we go. This is a title that I think Rabbi Kelman gave the class, the series, Megillat Esther and All Its Readers. It's a good title. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. You know, we know it's certainly in the U.S., it's still in Yana Dioma, people thinking that some books are just too dangerous. Like books that are, you know, they say things that shouldn't be put out in the masses, out for the masses. So that's going to be the question about Esther. Is Esther too dangerous? So we have to set the stage a little bit. Maybe I should actually close this for a bit. We actually set the stage for a little bit. So let's think about the setting of Jews who are going to first encounter the book of Esther. So we're talking about Jews in the times of Bayit Sheni, in the second Beit HaMikdash. You recall that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 586 BCE. The years don't matter that much, but time spans will matter a bit. So 586 BCE, there had been Nevuot. Yirmiyahu had said a couple of times that God is giving dominion to the Babylonians for 70 years. And lo and behold, 70 years later, the second Beit HaMikdash, 515 BCE, the second Beit HaMikdash is dedicated. 25 years before that, Cyrus, the Persian king, had taken over the Babylonian Empire and said, everyone could go live wherever they want. I really don't care where people live. I'm not interested in exiling people. So Jews, you can go back to Judea, to Yerushalayim. Arameans, go back to Aram. I'm not in the business of keeping people captive where they don't want to be. Everyone go live wherever they want. That was the formal end of the forced exile from the destruction of Bayit Rishon. But what was missing from that, and something that we'll spend some time on in a bit, was any sort of overt involvement of God. There were no miracles. There was no Kriyat Yamsuf. There was no thunder and lightning from heaven accompanying the Jews as they marched back from Babel to Eretz Israel. And in fact, very few Jews marched back from Babel to Eretz Israel. The vast majority of Jews just stayed where they were, because Cyrus didn't say you had to leave. Cyrus said you can leave. And some Jews were like, okay, that sounds interesting. Maybe we'll wait for the economy to get going. Some Jews said, that sounds interesting. I'm going to wait for God to say this, not Cyrus. I don't know who the Cyrus guy is, but that's not what I'm waiting for. And so in this, if we check back 25 years later, when the Beit HaMikdash is dedicated, it is impoverished, it is small, the population of Yerushalayim is quite underwhelming, both quantitatively and qualitatively. Jews are basically exactly where they were before Cyrus showed up, with the exception of a few thousand who had gone to Yerushalayim and rededicated the Beit HaMikdash. And this just continues. We're sort of waiting, you know, what's going to happen? When is this exile going to end? But nothing happens. God doesn't show up. The Arabian Peninsula doesn't split to allow the Jews to walk back quickly. Nothing dramatic takes place to indicate in a public, miraculous way that the Galut is over. And as this goes on and on and on, life in pragmatic terms is actually quite good. But the more that life is pragmatically good, the more it's theologically problematic for a lot of Jews. They're like, well, what's going on here? We're just living here in this new reality. Now we live under the Persians. The Persians are amazingly good at running an empire. Their empire lasted for more than two centuries. Of course, you know, at the time that we're talking about, they didn't know it was going to end. But it ended only because Alexander the Great showed up. I mean, the Persians were great. They were stable. It was secure. The wars that they were fighting, you know, we know about the Persian wars. The Persians are fighting off in Greece. The Persians are fighting off in Afghanistan. But if you lived in Iraq or Iran or Israel, well, things are just stable. They're just going on very peacefully, decade after decade, king after king, without any end in sight. And again, this is good for regular life. But what's good for regular life is more and more a theological problem. But what's going on? Like, what does this mean? What happened to all those promises about a return from exile? So now I'll put the slides back up. So I think Jews basically believed in a constellation of things that were becoming problematic. But here are the things that they believed in. They believed that the dynasty of David HaMelech would continue. This was written into Sefer Shmuel. It was seen in all sorts of texts. So David, of course, his dynasty, there are different branches of, but the dynasty of David will continue. They believed in endogamy, in marriage. They believed that marrying out of the Jewish community people was a problem. So that means we have to keep the community as a whole. They believed that there would be a new exodus. This is in, we're going to see this in detail, but it's in Yirmiyahu, it's in Yeshayahu, it's in Yechezkel, that the exile is going to end with a new and maybe even better Yetziat Mitzrayim. They believe that there was a sense of who a Jew was, who a Yehudi was. Again, something we'll come back to in more detail. They believe that Yerushalayim was the single most important part of the world, religiously and politically. And they believed that God was involved in the national life of the Jewish people. You could question whether God's involved in personal life. You can question whether God's involved in the Phoenicians' lives, but that God is involved in the life of national life of the Jewish people seemed beyond question. So this is the sort of constellation of what I would call sort of common Jewish beliefs in Bayit Sheni. And I don't think any of these seem controversial, right? So what I want to do today is to argue that one way of reading Megillat Esther is that the book actually disagrees with each one of these premises, that the book actually takes on each one of them and rejects them. If so, it's obviously a pretty radical book. So let's take them one at a time. So King David, the dynasty of David HaMelech. Well, David, of course, is dead. The dynasty doesn't exist as long as there's no kingship. And right now in exile, there is no kingship. There had been debates among the Nevi'im as to which branch of Beit David would rule in the future. Yirmiyahu explicitly says it won't be from the branch of Yehoyachin, that second to last king of Yehudah. He's written out. He's not going to be his descendants will never sit on the throne again. Yechezkel, on the other hand, says, no, it is going to be from Yehoyachin. Yehoyachin is with him, with Yechezkel in exile. But I want to emphasize, these are all debates within the dynasty of Beit David. Both Yechezkel and Yirmiyahu take for granted that someone from Beit David will be the legitimate ruler of a Jewish people. Who actually wound up ruling a Jewish people at the beginning of Bayit Sheni? Oh, a guy named Zerubbabel, who was in fact the grandson of Yehoyachin. So this is that very first movement of Jews back to Eretz Yisrael. Is led by two people, Sheshbatzar and Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel, despite his lovely Babylonian name, is a third generation descendant of Yehoyachin. So first of all, this certainly sides with Yechezkel. History sided with Yechezkel over Yirmiyahu in thinking about whether Yehoyachin's descendants would ever be the leaders of the Jewish people again. And second of all, also important to emphasize, when the Jews came back, there's not a king, but the political leader is from the Davidic dynasty. This can't be an accident. This means that the Jews are still looking to Beit David for leadership. When we're going to have a leader, it's obviously going to come from Beit David. And of course, that idea is alive and well in later Judaism also. You think about like the Reish Galuta and Talmudic times, who always traced his lineage back to Beit David. So Beit David is sort of taken for granted that the political leader of the Jews will come from Beit David. What about in Esther? Who are the leaders in Esther? Well, not only are they not from Beit David, not only are they not from Shevet Yehuda, but they're actually linked with Shaul HaMelech rather than David HaMelech. Mordechai and Esther are certainly from the same tribe, from Binyamin. Mordechai is said to be an Ish Yemini from the tribe of Binyamin. But also linked, possibly genealogically, definitely literarily, with Shaul over and over and over again. Now, I want to work through this with you for a couple of minutes. But before I do, let me just emphasize how radical this is. Shaul has been cut out of the leadership 500 years ago. This is not a live option that like maybe we should bring back Beit Shaul as a king. There is no Beit Shaul dynasty that's been vying for the kingship. Shaul goes back to literally like, probably around the year 10, about the year 1000, 1010 or so BCE is when Shaul himself dies. That's the end of the Shaul dynasty. Now we're sitting after the year 500. Ahasuerush comes to the throne in 485. It is nonsense to say that we're going to bring back the dynasty of Shaul. There is no dynasty here. So the political stakes of arguing that the leaders here are associated with Shaul are not because we need to bring back Shaul's dynasty. But what it is of course, the role that Shaul plays is not so much Shaul the king, but the great rival to David. Bringing back Shaul means neglecting and rejecting the Davidic dynasty, Beit David. So let's look at how Mordechai and Esther are in fact linked with Shaul. So it starts at the very beginning of our introduction to Mordechai and Esther. So the chart, I set up this chart, so Shaul, who is first, obviously, but he's here in the middle, and the Megillah, which is our primary text, is here on the right. So when we read, this may be actually not the way we all experience it, because it's possible that for many of us, certainly me, Megillat Esther is a more familiar text than Shmuel Aleph. But in any event, when we read in Esther Bet, Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan Bira u'shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ishimini, Asher hagla Yerushalayim imagola, Asher hoglatayim yichonya melech Yehuda, Asher hagla nebuchanetzer melech Bavel, Vahi omenet hadasahi Esther, we are immediately going to be reminded of Shaul in numerous ways. First of all, Kish is, of course, Shaul's father's name. Whether this is the Kish, the same Kish or not, is an open question, but that name is not a common name. And so we're going to have Kish. And from the tribe of Binyamin, Ishmini. Okay. Shaul is called to mind. But also the structure of this introduction is reminiscent of the introduction of Shaul. When we first meet Shaul, we heard, Vahi ish mi binyamin ushmo kish ben aviel ben sror ben bechorat ben afiach ben ish yemini gibor chayel v'lo haya vein ushmo shaul bachur vatov. So the structure is similar, the names are similar, binyamin ish yemini is similar, and in both introductions, we're actually introduced first to the character who is raising the main character who we need to hear about. So first we hear about Mordechai, and then we hear Vahi Omenet Hadasahi Esther, who's the character we actually need to know about right now, because in this context, the king has just called for all beautiful virgins to be called to the palace. So we need to know about Hadasahi Esther. In the case of Shaul, we're introduced to Kish, but then we're told, we don't care about Kish. Lo haya ben ushmo Shaul b'choruto. He had a son named Shaul. So the introductions are, again, both structurally similar. They sound similar. They even have some of the same names and the same terms. So as soon as we read Esther, and if the author of Esther assumes that the readership is going to be familiar generally with biblical texts, as soon as you read Esther, you're like, oh, I know what you're alluding to. I get it. You're associating your heroes. Can't wait to hear more about them. You're associating your heroes with the lineage of Shaul. Okay, let's see where this goes. Both of them, we have things like Ein Esther Magedet Moladata. Well, in the very next parak in Shmuel, we had a Dvar HaMelucha Lo Higidlo. So we have important things being hidden from the main characters. And then the thematic similarities take over. And these are really quite profound. And lots of readers from Chazal and the Midrash down through modern scholars have drawn attention to most or all of these. So of course, Shaul lost his kingship for failing to destroy Agag, the king of Amalek, whereas Mordechai and Esther succeed by defeating Haman Ha'agagi. It's actually, I'm sincerely unsure what an Agagi is, but it can't be an accident that Agagi links with Agag, Melech Amalek. So in that case, Mordechai and Esther are rectifying the mistake that Shaul committed. Shaul failed to kill Agag. Mordechai and Esther defeat the Agagi. One of Shaul's early mistakes you probably remember the story, but in Perek Yud Aleph, there was a challenge to his authority, and it says that Vahi Macharish, he remains silent. What does Mordechai tell Esther? You must not Tacharishi. Right? You must not remain silent. So again, Mordechai is making sure in this case that Esther doesn't repeat the mistake of Shaul. Shaul made a mistake and lost his authority because he was Macharish. Therefore, Esther must not be Maharisha. Some links that are more on the verbal side. Shmuel tells Shaul, "Lemi kol chandat Yisrael, lechol beit avicha." Who does all of Israel want? You and beit avicha. Of course, Mordechai tells Esther that, well, that's the problem. If you remain silent, im hacharish tacharishi beit hazot, atu beit avich tovedu. That same beit av, that same ancestral house, father's house, will be lost. Exactly what Shmuel told Shaul was needed by the people. Mordechai tells Esther is in jeopardy if she doesn't act decisively. This one's a little bit more technical, but maybe interesting for just that reason. In Shmuel Aleph Perek Kaf, Shaul, I'm sure you remember this story, Shaul hosts a feast on one day, and then the next day hosts another feast. At the first feast, nothing exciting happens. At the second one, try to write this carefully, the host, Shaul, becomes enraged at one guest, his son Yonatan, for betraying him and protecting David. And Yonatan's commentary on this is, Kalta hara'a me'imo. Then Shaul, Kalta hara'a me'imo, Shaul definitely intends evil. And then Yonatan gets up from the table angrily. Vayakom Yonatan me'ima shulchan b'chori af. Okay, so remember all those details when I tell you this story. In Esther, the queen hosts two banquets on successive days. The first one passes uneventfully, while at the second one, the king rises angrily and leaves, and Haman observes, ki kalta elav hara'a me'et hamelech. The same exact phrase used at that second banquet to conclude that the king has indeed decided to do evil against him. So that is kind of a technical way of telling the story, but there's no way that such plot coincidences are just coincidences. I mean, they match way too carefully and too closely to be anything other than an intentional allusion to the story of Shaul. Finally, Shaul found revach only through David, whereas Mordechai tells Esther that she has to bring revach v'atzalah, revach, to the people. So especially if we're thinking of this as a repudiation of the reliance on Beit David, a rejection of the expectations that Beit David is going to come, Shaul only got revach from Beit David, from David himself, I'm sorry. And Mordechai tells Esther, now it's all on you. You have to bring revach. And in the last example of rectifying mistakes of Shaul, in Shmuel Aleph Tetvav, that same war with Amalek, Bnei Israel brought back spoils of war from Amalek, and this, of course, is what made Shmuel very upset to begin with. In the end of Esther, which has its own moral problems, but the end of Esther, the Jews don't touch the spoils, even though they were explicitly given permission to do so. So we see a lot of things going on here. Let me try to summarize it like this. On the one hand, Mordechai and Esther are living the patterns of Shaul. So much of the story takes its cue from things that happened to Shaul. But on the other hand, and very importantly, it goes beyond Shaul by fixing all the mistakes that Shaul made. So under Shaul, they took the plunder. Under Shaul, he didn't kill Agag. Under Shaul, revach was only found at the hands of someone else, his rival David. In Mordechai and Esther's case, don't worry. They've got this under control. They will not take the spoils. They do kill the Agagi, and revach is going to be brought by Mordechai and Esther themselves. So all of this is to say that the Megillah seems to be saying that Shaul was a predecessor, a flawed predecessor. Mordechai and Esther are going to pick up on what Shaul did and improve on him. Sorry, I don't see everyone on the screen at the same time. Does someone want to say something?
Dr.
Kohler, Siri Rudolph.
Oh, hi, Siri. How are you? I will find you on the screen, I'm sure, but go ahead.
Good. Just quickly, that when Shaul doesn't do what he was supposed to to do with Agag. Shmuel says to him that they're going to give the kingdom L'Re'acha HaTov Mimecha. Right. And when Vashti doesn't do what she's supposed to do,
wonderful.
It says that they'll give it the kingdom to the Re'ah HaTovah Mimena.
Wonderful. Thank you. Great point. Great point.
Rabbi that. Silber.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. All right, so good. So let's take that as point number one. So if I go back to our original list and say, well, all Jews assume that political leadership would come from Beit David. Well, here's a book that says, no, not Beit David. And not only not Beit David, but David's great rival, the one who he had to take the throne away from. So Shaul is going to be the hero, the great ancestral hero for Megillat Esther. Okay, so that's point one that Esther challenges, subverts. Point two, this one is pretty straightforward, actually. And I'm kind of always, I always wonder how we don't spend more time worried about this. But yeah, Jews seem to have assumed that intermarriage was a bad thing in Bayit Sheni times. Yeah, let me put this slideshow back up. It's hard to say unambiguously that this is a biblical prohibition, intermarriage. In Devarim, we have things like you shouldn't marry the Shiva Amamim, shouldn't intermarry the Shiva Amamim, lo titchatein bam, bitcha lo titchatein livno, bito lo tikach livnecha. That's specifically about the Shiva Amamim. We also have with regard to Amoni Moavi. So we have specific prohibited marriages in Chumash, but in Bayit Sheni times, it's become a much more generalized prohibition. So, for example, Ezra and Nehemiah both get very upset about Jews in Yerushalayim who have married other people. Now, there are no Shiva Amim, even though Ezra says, it says in the Torah, you're not allowed to marry the Kanani, the Chiti, the Prizi, the Yebusi, the Amoni, the Moavi, Mitzri, Emori, which is, first of all, not an actual pasuk. He's combining different psukim. But second of all, the people that they're marrying are not Hittites. There are no Hittites around in Bayit Sheni times. They're not marrying Hittites. Ezra's generalizing this and saying, the real point is you're not allowed to intermarry. You're not allowed to marry anyone other than people from our community. And yet, this sort of is, so obvious that I'm ashamed to have to say it out loud, but Esther is intermarried. This is not a subtle point. Did Esther have a choice? Fair question. What does choice really mean? Actually, a really good question. As Jean-Paul Sartre always, said, like, there's always a choice, right? There's always martyrdom as an option. Like, there's always a way out. And that's not a trivial thing to say because, of course, the Gemara asks, why was Esther not obligated to martyr herself? Why was she allowed to sleep with a non-Jewish king? And there's a lot to unpack about that Gemara, like what exactly was wrong with this. And the answers that the Gemara gives are really interesting and challenging. But I just want to emphasize how problematic this really is. She's intermarried. And not only is she intermarried at the beginning of the book, when you could plausibly say that there is an issue here of pikuach nefesh, maybe for her, maybe, if you think sort of cosmically, as Mordechai says later, mi yodea and leit kazot yigat lamachud, maybe this is, there's some perception that this is important in the long run. Okay, fine. But you know what? What happens after she comes out and says that she's a Jew? She's still intermarried. She doesn't say, okay, now that I've told you I'm a Jew and, I've already saved the Jewish people, I can't really remain with you unless you convert, or we're going to have to kosher the kitchen. And by the way, from now on, every 7 days, I'm not going to be showing up at your party. Like, there's nothing. She just lives happily ever after as the intermarried queen of Persia. And there is no apology for this. There's no attempt made to cover it up or to correct it. Nothing at all. And although it's not in the realm of intermarriage specifically, a really good contrast with this is the very beginning of the book of Daniel. Remember that at the very beginning of the book of Daniel, Daniel and his friends are taken captive to the palace. And the first thing they say is, we can't eat the meat or drink the wine. And the Babylonian official is like, well, it's going to be bad for your health. We need to make sure you grow up to be big and strong. So, okay, let's see if we can be big and strong on a vegan diet. And it turns out they can be. And by the way, it turns out that we all can be, but that's a different issue. but Esther has none of this. There is not a word in Megillat Esther about excusing her marriage, apologizing for the food, trying to address, you know, how she was able to drink the wine or eat the meat in the palace. If you ask, you know, what did Esther eat in the palace, is actually a question the Gemara asks and has different views on. The Gemara Megillah asks the question, what did she eat in the palace? And there are different views. But the straightforward reading, and again, I'm not arguing right now this is the correct reading, just that it's a plausible reading. So one plausible reading is she's making no apologies because it's not such a big deal. She's intermarried. She's eating non-kosher. She's, you know, as far as we can tell, not keeping Shabbat. The Zoroastrians are actually had stricter rules of menstruation than Halacha does. So she might not have had a Nida problem, but that's, you know, not something that the Megillah makes a big deal about. But in general, there's just no apology here for all of the really blatant religious violations that Esther is living with throughout the entire Megillah. So point number two that the Megillah is plausibly radical on is in celebrating a woman who in fact does save the Jewish people, but does so through a life of sin, through a life of intermarriage and violation of virtually everything else as well.
Rabbi Kohler?
Yeah, please.
A class I once took with you many years ago, you had made the point that Yehudi made a point of saying, oh no, I only eat, you know, veggies, and bringing her lentils to the palace when she meets Holofernes.
Right, right. That's a great point. So I actually want to, we'll come back to that, I hope, in a couple of weeks, because the book of,
you know,
of
the things were very, 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 very different then. And religion was where you were. And generally what happened with the whole exile and territorial shakeup after the destruction of the first temple, things lost control. It used to be you didn't have conversion. It was nothing like today.
Mm.
Okay, and let's speak.
No, Bayer, that's a,
what happened with the whole
Bayer, one second. So thank you. That's a really important point, and I think that's absolutely a correct point. So let me come back to that from a slightly different angle in a second. Zella, to your point, Judith, I think, and we'll hopefully see this in a couple of weeks, is to some extent a response to Esther, saying like, oh, you want a good Jewish heroine who takes on the foreign king. Here's an example where you could do it without giving up on all of your important principles. So yeah. Important text, but we'll come back to it.
Yeah, yes.
Let me just clarify something in response to what Batya said. I am certainly not, I'm not even arguing this is correct right now. I'm just arguing that a reader may have looked at this and said like, oh, this is, you know, very problematic. Like, let me ask you the following question. Do I want to tell my kids this story before they go to bed at night? I'm not sure. They might grow up thinking that it doesn't matter if they marry a Jew or not, as long as they're like, loyal to the Jews when life and death are on the line. I don't know if I want my kids to know that. I'd rather tell them the stories of Daniel, who got to the palace and said, no way I'm eating the meat or drinking the wine. So it's a dangerous story in that regard. And that's really all I want to say. Whether or not that was what the author meant, I don't know. Whether it's even like the shot of the Megillah, I'm officially agnostic on those questions right now. I just want to say that it's a plausible reading of the story and therefore potentially a dangerous reading of the story. I just want to add in response to what Batya said, even if I thought this was absolutely the right reading of the story, I certainly wouldn't want to be in the business of judging Esther or anyone else for their decisions. That's certainly not what I mean. I would just be observant. Sandra?
Add a little bit to Zella's point about Judith and.
Wait, sorry, you know what? If it's going to be about Judith, I want to spend some real time on Judith in a couple of weeks.
I know that, and that's why I just wanted to say, since people might be thinking, because you said that Judith was a corrective to Esther, we have to keep in mind that, we have to think Judith was a book that wasn't included in the canon. So if in fact Judith's behavior and the story of Judith, which never made it in, was a corrective to Esther. Take a look. We should be scratching our heads. And I hope you address this somewhat. That what maybe her fate was not to be included in the canon. And we'd say to ourselves, So I just wanted to sort of stick that in as a little bit of a ringer.
Yeah.
If you're saying it was a response to Esther as a corrective to Esther, we're thinking, what happened to her?
Yeah, wonderful. Someone has their hands up.
Hold on. 1 second, if you don't mind. Normally, we leave questions always till the end. If Dr. Kohler prefers, this, I don't mind, but I know a lot of people have said they prefer waiting to the end. If you feel you want to cover the material and take questions to the end, I want to give you that ability. And then we'll just ask people to put questions in the chat box. When class is over, you can also unmute yourself. I think that's a little better. If you have a particular question, particular time you want to ask somebody, feel free to do so. But I think that is the better
method. Are you asking Dr. Kohler or telling him, Jay?
I'm asking. Okay. I'm doing a combination of both.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Maybe we'll do this one last one, and then we'll try to get through another good chunk of the material.
Okay, I'm the one last one. In Divrei Yamim Aleph, in the genealogy section, and that is in the Tanakh, and that's clearly from the Persian period, there's no ands, ifs, or buts about is Jews marrying people who are not Jewish. There's a whole slew of stories in the genealogies about this one married a Moavi, and this one married an Amoni, and this one married this, and this one married that, and Divrei Yamim never, ever gives you the slightest disapproval of one of those intermarriages on the grounds that it's an intermarriage. And not only that, talks about children that come from those intermarriages and the yichus of those children. I mean, it's not even an issue for Sefer Divrei Yamim, and that's a book that was written in the Persian period, probably after Megillat Esther. So I don't need Judith.
That's a great point.
Here I have a book in the Tanakh, which clearly has no problem with intermarriage.
Yeah, okay. I think that last formulation might be a little stronger than I'd be comfortable with, but your point's really well taken. And certainly, if we were going to try to map all of the different views on what was considered intermarriage, how bad would it be, then you're absolutely right. I would 100% agree that Divrei Yamim would be on what I, until now, have sort of said is the Megillat Esther end of the spectrum here, with, as you say, sort of a sanguine acceptance. You know, whether it's a non-issue or just tolerated is hard to know, but it's certainly not condemned. And there's a lot to unpack there. I do hope later on we will have a chance, not this week, we will have a chance to spend a little bit more time thinking about this, because some of the reactions to Esther explicitly take this on. Say, wait a second, this is not okay, because how could she be intermarried? So we'll certainly have to think, as you just intimated, how clear was it to people that intermarriage was something terrible? I put one text up here just for now, and I'll close this section with this. This is from the Book of Jubilees, which is another Bayit Sheni Jewish book, probably about 30 years before the Chashmonaim, which retells the stories of Bereishit and half of Shemot. And I do hope, as I just said, we'll come back to the topic of intermarriage. But one text for right now, in retelling the story of Shimon and Levi and Shechem, it says, the Jubilees says they killed everyone in Shechem because they had dishonored their sister Dinah. And in fact, here's the problem, says Jubilees. That's intermarriage. If there's any man who wishes in Israel to give his daughter or his sister to any man who is of the seed of the Gentiles, he shall surely die, and they shall stone him with stones, for he hath wrought shame in Israel. And they shall burn the woman with fire, because she had dishonored the name of the house of her father, and she shall be rooted out of Israel. Moses, command the children of Israel, exhort them not to give their daughters to the Gentiles and not to take for their sons any of the daughters of the Gentiles, for this is an abominable before the Lord. So Yehudi might be right that some people were okay with it, or at least not like this, upset about it. Some Bayit Sheni Jews were inordinately upset about it, and in fact ruled that it was a chiyuv mita to intermarry, both for the woman and for the father who would marry his daughter to a non-Jew, and for a man who married a non-Jewish woman. So you can imagine that those people, you know, someone who likes the Book of Jubilees and reads something like this and is like, yeah, that's right, would then look at Esther and be like, there's no way I'm telling my kids this story. Like, we're not dressing up for Purim this year. It's just, we can't do this. So, okay, so again, the point here is simply that Esther is potentially saying something quite radical and dangerous. Okay, let's move on. I mentioned the expectations of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Jews were like, okay, one day we're going to go back to Eretz Israel. It'll happen with a lot of miracles. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this topic, and then I'm going to pause and see what questions we have. And we'll pause after this topic to to take stock of that. So this is, I said, it's in a lot of the Nevi'im. So here's one line that is quite a powerful line from Yirmiyahu. This is Tetzayim, but he repeats the same thing basically verbatim in Kaf Gimel. L'chein hine yamim ba'im ne'um Hashem. V'lo ye'amer od chai Hashem asher he'alat b'nei Yisrael me'aretz Mitzrayim. People, it will no longer be said. People will no longer, just in conversation, swear by God who brought B'nai Israel from Egypt. It's not what people will say. People will say, Chai Hashem asher he'alat B'nai Israel me'eretz tzafon mikol ha'aratot asher hidicham shama v'ashivotim alad matam asher natati lavotam. They'll just call God something else. They won't say, God who brought Egypt, Israel out of Egypt. They'll say, God who brought Israel out of the northern land from all the lands which to which he had scattered them and who returned them to their land which he had given to their ancestors. In other words, this future redemption is just going to overshadow Yetziat Mitzrayim to such an extent that no one will even talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim anymore. It's just not going to be on people's lips. We talk about it all the time because it is the archetype of divine intervention in our history. It is the example where God stepped in and effected a salvation. So we talk about it all the time. It's in our tefillot, it's in Kriyat Shema, it's just all over the place how many things are Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim. And Yirmiyahu says, yeah, well, that's because right now there's nothing better to talk about. But in the future, we're going to have a better story to tell. And once we have a better story, we're not going to tell the story of the Exodus anymore. And this is the issue that's sort of behind that question in the Megillah, which is not first. I'm sorry, not Megillah, Haggadah, which is not original to the Haggadah, but the question of will we still be talking about Yetziat Mitzrayim Limot HaMashiach? The Yirmiyahu's claim is there's not going to be any point in talking about Yetziat Mitzrayim Limot HaMashiach. Limot HaMashiach for him, of course, is not 3,000 years from then. It's as soon as God brings us back from the Babylonian exile, we're going to stop talking about the Exodus because it will be overshadowed by this new redemption. That's not just this one line in Yirmiyahu. Yechezkel develops this in a lot of detail. He actually does this in a couple of places. I gave you one here. Yechezkel actually has a sort of vicious twist on this idea that the new redemption is going to be even better than the Yetziat Mitzrayim. Yechezkel in general, I should say, has a vicious twist on pretty much everything. He's just not nice about it. Anything. Like there's no loving kindness in Yechezkel. It is violent kingship of God at gunpoint, essentially. But God will rule. So, having given that exciting introduction, Yechezkel says, Chai ani ne'um Hashem Elokim, imlo biyad chazaka uvizroa netuya uvechema shfucha emloch aleichem. God says, I will absolutely reign over you. Now, as soon as anyone says the words, Yad Chazaka and Zrona Tuya, we get the illusion, right? I mean, you can use a concordance to look up where these things appear, but every single case, with one possible exception in Tanakh, where the words Yad Chazaka and Zrona Tuya are used, is either actually in the case of Yetziat Mitzrayim or recalling Yetziat Mitzrayim. In other words, this phrase is absolutely connected to Yetziat Mitzrayim. So as soon as Yechezkel says that, his whole audience gets like, okay, we're talking about Yetziat Mitzrayim here. But of course, Yechezkel added something, right? Yad Chazaka Zrona Tuya and Chemash Fucha, this outpoured wrath. Now, who's that directed against? Well, unfortunately, it turns out to be directed against us. But before we get to the details there, V'hotzeiti etchem min ha'amim v'kibatzti etchem min ha'aratzot asher nefutzotem bam b'yad chazaka u'v'zro netuya u'v'chema shfucha v'heveiti etchem al midbar ha'amim v'nishpatati etchem sham panim el panim k'asher nishpatati et avotechem b'midbar eretz Mitzrayim kein yishafet etchem ne'um Hashem Elokim. So in case you hadn't gotten the illusion until you got to Pasuk Bamid Vav, Yechezkel's like, this is just like the Exodus from Egypt, right? except that what he's focusing on is not so much the beneficial miracles that God did in the Exodus from Egypt. It's the bringing you to the wilderness, bringing you to the Midbar, and there I will enter into judgment with you face to face. Now, he's also used the words v'hotzeiti, v'heveiti, and so he's made it as explicit as possible that this is going to be Yetziat Mitzrayim Redux. But Yechezkel's twist on this is that it's not all about getting out of Avdut and going to Chirut. In fact, it's all about God's kingship. So he continues, I'm going to not read Pasuk Lamed Zayin, I'm going to skip to Membet right now. Vidatem ki ani Hashem bavi'i etchem el admat Yisrael el ha'aretz asher nesati et yadi latet l'tat la'avotichem. So you will know that I am king when I get you to the land of Israel. It's not about you being freed. It's about me being king. Me, God, being king. But here's the key point here. The tzad ha-shaveh, the common denominator between what Yechezkel is saying here and what Yirmiyahu said in the pasuk we looked at a minute ago, is that the galut will end in Bavel through absolutely overt, explicit divine involvement. Right? This is not an exile that's just going to sort of peter out when the UN declares that there's a partition plan. It's an exile that's going to end when God steps in and does dramatic things. Now, for Yirmiyahu, this seems like dramatically positive. For Yechezkel, it seems like dramatically painful. But in any event, it's dramatic and direct involvement of God. One last text here, just to make it clear, this is not just like I dug up two passages, you know, buried in Nevi'im, but it's also in Yeshayahu. Like every Navi who talked about the Galut says that it's going to end in a dramatic divine way. This one is in Yeshayahu Nun Aleph. I'm sorry. So this is the second half of Yeshayahu. Many modern scholars think this is not the Navi Yeshayahu ben Amotz, but a later Navi. It's not our topic for today. What is important is that L'kulei Alma, everyone agrees that these Nevuot are addressed to the Jews in Galut Bavel. Right? This is in the section that has like Nachamu starts, Nachamu Nachamu Ami, Yomar Lekechem, that explicitly talks about Koresh. God arousing the spirit of Koresh to let the Jews go back. And down here in Perek Nun Aleph, the Navi says, turns to God and says, Uri, Uri, Livshi Oz Zeroa Hashem, Uri Kime Kedem Dorot Olamim. Wake up, O arm of God. Garb yourself in strength. Wake up like in old days, generations long gone. Halo ati hamachzevet Rahav, mecholela tanin. Aren't you the one who hacked up Rahav? And this seems to be a reference to some like mythological creature that, of course, the Torah never tells us about, but apparently there were stories about God having defeated some other creatures, hacked them up, not necessarily in any dangerous battle, but in calming chaos and creating the world. Mecholela tanin. But then more to our point, Pasuk Yud, Halo Atia Machrevet Yam, aren't you the one who dried up the sea, made to home Rabbah, the waters of the great depth, Hasama Ma'amake Yam Derech La'avor Ge'ulim? Aren't you the one who made a path among the, inside the depths of the sea for the redeemed ones to pass through? So we sort of moved from mythical ideas of God defeating other monsters or something, to God splitting the sea and allowing Bnei Yisrael to pass through. And now the Navi says, Ufduye Hashem Yishuvun, Uvau Tzion Birina, V'simchat Olam Arosham Sason, V'simcha Yasigun, Nasu Yagon V'anacha. So again, let those who are liberated by God return, Ufduye Hashem Yishuvun, let them come back to Tzion with Rina, with the eternal happiness on their heads, and so on. So again, the Navi looks back to Yetziat Mitzrayim for the precedent of what's to come. Aren't you the one who split the sea and therefore let the redeemed ones pass through? Do it again. Do it again. Let the redeemed ones come back to Tzion rejoicing. So all of this are the texts that would have been known to Jews in Bayit Sheni, which foretold the end of the Galut as coming in dramatic, miraculous, explicit divine ways that would overshadow, draw on, and maybe totally eviscerate our memory of Yetziat Mitzrayim, because this is just going to be so much grander and greater. This isn't even all the text, but I think the point's been made. What does Esther say about all this? Well, there's sort of two answers to that. On the one hand, you might say Esther says nothing about all this, right? Just nothing. I mean, there is no Geula in Megillat Esther. At the end of the day, as Rava, the Babylonian Amora, as Rava says many, many centuries later, he says, why would I say Hallel today? Akate Avdei D'Achashverosh Anan, right? I'm still sitting here in Achashverosh's land. Like, what is this Geula? Like, nothing's happened here. Like, at the end of the day, the Jews are exactly where they were at the beginning of the story. Nothing has changed from beginning to end. And yet, the book says we have to rejoice. We have to celebrate. There's something to celebrate. What are we celebrating? Well, we're celebrating not dying. No, look, that's better than just dying. I mean, you know, we should celebrate not dying. But this is not the Geula that the Nevi'im were talking. Like, what happened to Yetziat Mitzrayim? Like, you know, 2.0, like, better and grander than anything we've ever seen before. Like, we're not stopping to talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim because God hasn't done anything. In fact, of course, we'll come back to this, but God literally hasn't done anything, as the book tells it. There's just no involvement whatsoever. So on one level, what Esther's comment is, Megillah's comment on this whole question of like Yetziat Mitzrayim is resounding silence. There's no Yetziat Mitzrayim. But there's actually something even more than that, because the Megillah does say something implicitly about Yetziat Mitzrayim. Because if we pay attention, when does the story of the Megillah actually take place? Well, all you have to do is pay attention to the dates, right? So we're reading Perek Gimel, and we heard that Haman has his decree, Vayikaru Sofrei HaMelech B'Chodesh HaRishon B'Shloshasar Bo Yom Bo, Vayikatev K'chol Asher Tziva Haman Al Achashtar Pnei HaMelech V'El HaPachot, right? So the 13th day of the first month, Haman calls in the scribes to send out his genocidal decrees. Just to make sure this is totally clear, the first month is, of course, Nisan. This is not even a question in Esther, because we know the 12th month is Adar. Some of the months are explicitly double identified as the number and the name. So, okay, 13th of Nisan. Wait a second, 13th of Nisan. Where are all the Jews at this point? Oh, deep in Pesach preparation, right? I mean, the houses are kosher, the Seder's pretty much ready, like everyone's getting, tomorrow night's the Seder. In the meantime, Haman's sending out these decrees. Immediately, or maybe, you know, within a few hours, maybe a day, but I don't see why it should take a day, Mordechai goes to the Shar HaMelech, talks to Esther, they have their conversation, and Esther says at the end of their conversation, V'tomer Esther la'shiva Mordechai, Lech knoset kol ha'yudim ha'mitziim b'shushan mitzumu alai v'al tuchlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim. Laila v'yom. Now, no matter what you do with the arithmetic, those 3 days include Pesach, include Leil HaSeder. And in fact, there's a lovely midrash. There's a lot of midrashim on Esther, more than on any other book in Tanakh except for Bereishit. And there's a lovely midrash in one of these midrashic collections that actually has Mordechai saying to Esther, Esther, we can't fast tomorrow night. It's Pesach. We have to have the Seder. And Esther says, she's not nice in the Midrash. She says, you're an idiot. You're a leader in Israel and you're such an idiot. If we don't fast for these 3 days, there will never be another Pesach in Jewish history. So we'll give up one Pesach so we can celebrate Pesach for years to come. So I mention that now just to say that Chazal were, you know, like every careful reader, like, noticed immediately that this is taking place on Pesach, that the story of Esther takes place on Pesach. But that's potentially more than just an annoying detail because, you know, we all cooked already for the Seder and now we have to fast for 3 days. Potentially, especially when you put it in light of what we just saw, that the Jews are expecting Yetziat Mitzrayim to be redone soon, Megillat Esther might be saying something totally radical. Say, oh, you're waiting for an Exodus-like event here in exile, here in Babylon, here in Persia? We're not getting that. Here's what we're getting. We're getting a story that takes place in Nisan, on Tetvav Nisan itself. So it's just like Yetziat Mitzrayim in some ways. And yet, it is the exact opposite of the original Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exact opposite of what you're expecting here. There is no God. There is no miracle. There is no exodus. There's no leaving anywhere. In fact, as Rava says, like we're still here, nothing's changed. And yet, this is the kind of geulah that we can expect here in exile. You can't expect God to show up and split the sea for us anymore. All you can hope is that there will be Jews in good enough position to outmaneuver the enemy so at the end of the story, we are alive as we were at the beginning of the story. And you know what? That's also worth a holiday. But that is a far cry from what the Jews were hoping to hear about Geula, about redemption in Galut Bavel. And Esther might be saying, just forget those hopes, guys. It's not happening. Like, there's no big exodus coming along. It's been now, you know, we're in Achashverosh's time. As mentioned, Achashverosh comes to the throne in 485. This is now the 11th year of Achashverosh. Is that right? So they're in 474. So, you know, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed 112 years ago. Like, there's nothing happening. Like, just stop talking about, like, oh, but Yirmiyahu said, oh, but Yechezkel. Like, guys, I don't know what happened, but put it aside. The Geulah that we have here is of a very different type. But this is what we have here. This is real life. This is not a new Exodus, but it is a Geulah worth celebrating. So in this regard, too, and again, I'm not arguing this is necessarily the meaning of Esther, but it's a plausible way of reading Esther. Esther's just rejecting what Jews were saying commonly. Jews were saying, someone from Beit David is going to come and lead us out of Galut Bavel. And Esther's like, actually, forget Beit David. Shaul's what we got now. And we're not going anywhere. We're just going to try to survive here in exile. So that third day, depending on how you do the arithmetic, the third day may plausibly actually be the 15th day of Nisan. Maybe it's the 16th day of Nisan. I'm not sure. Really, the text is not explicit enough to know how many days have passed between the decree. But however you figure this out, this is taking place on Pesach. And therefore, I could certainly read this as a rejection of the expectations of a new Exodus. Okay, I said we would pause here. Anyway, time is ticking. So let's pause and see. I know the chat's been, I know it keeps dinging. So I'm going to just scroll through and see if there's something I can respond to right now, and then we'll continue this next week. Okay, so a bunch of comments I'm not going to read. I know you can all read these comments also. But Asher, I do think your question about was the War of Independence a dramatic divine event is a fantastic question that is really, I think, at the core of the question of, well, what counts as a geula? What counts as something worth celebrating religiously? That I think the Book of Esther is really interested in probing. Is this religious? Well, I mean, we haven't gotten to this yet, but of course there's no overt God. So what do we do with that? Okay. Ellen, I am not assuming that the composition of the book is roughly contemporaneous. I think it's probably about 75 years later, but we could talk more about that next week. Okay. And then I guess, William, when you asked about the dating of the story, you mean when the story happened or when the book was written? Yeah, so since a couple of people asked that, I should have put a timeline up at the beginning. I can do this at the beginning of class next time. But the basic years are that Ahasuerus comes to the throne in 485 BCE. We know him pretty well. His name is Xerxes in English, which, of course, is not anywhere close to his actual name. His actual name is Xerxes in Persian. So Ahasuerus is actually much closer to his Persian name than Xerxes. But through Greek and Latin and into English, we call him Xerxes. So you can look him up. You know, he did all sorts of important things. He's well known for fighting off in Greece, losing, but fighting off in Greece. If you you know, remember the story of the 300, so Xerxes led that invasion, and so then, you know, once you know his years, you can sort of follow the chronology. So the third year of Ahasuerus is where the story begins. The seventh year is where the contest happens. The 12th year, I said 11th earlier. The 12th year is when the story of Purim takes place. So 474 to 473 BCE is when the story takes place. That's not an answer to the question of when the book was written. That's a much harder question. I think it's clearly later. It's hard to be specific about how much later. I would venture as a plausible, but not certain date, around the year 400 BCE. So a number of generations later that the book is written. But we could talk about that more as well, because we will have to talk about the passages in Chazal, which are all over Chazal, about Esther having written the book and then asking to be in Tanakh. So the authorship is one question. I think a much more interesting question is like this sort of attributed self-consciousness, like, I want to be a biblical book. That's a really interesting dynamic that we will certainly come back to.
Learning with the late Professor Bernstein in YU, maybe 50 or 60 years ago, he made mention of something from the Anchor Bible, that the words in the Megillah are in fact meat parashamadai, and that hence the Megillah couldn't have been written until around 400, 380 BCE, because of the words used. And he felt that the book and the events were contemporaries.
Interesting. I'm not sure how that would be. I suppose we could talk about this later. But since Achashverosh is pretty securely dated, the writing of the book is an open question, but the events themselves don't seem like an open question much at all.
You're assuming that the book was written in the second Beit HaMikdash is already built.
I am assuming that, right.
Right, no, it's fine. Of course, no. Obviously, yeah, yeah. Chazal had a different understanding, right. But later, and no problem. Absolutely. But it actually makes your point much stronger. In other words, the subversiveness, whatever word, that's a strong word you want to use as you're reading, makes it even stronger, because the temple is standing in Yerushalayim and they're still saying, you know, here we are. I guess it's no different than us here. I live
no,
in
that's
Chicago,
wonderful.
But,
that's wonderful. Anyway. So that's actually the point that we're going to start with next week. So next week, I'll have a timeline ready to show you so we can step through this a little bit. But Rabbi Kelman's point is exactly the point that we'll start with. Especially if Yerushalayim has a Jewish community, it's before Ezra Nehemiah, so it has a small Jewish community, but it has a Jewish community, and as you say, very importantly, has a Beit HaMikdash that functions, even if it's unimpressive, but it's functioning. Then the studious ignoring of Yerushalayim throughout Megillat Esther, except for that one reference that Mordechai's great grandfather was exiled from there, certainly sounds like a resounding silence that may be ideologically significant. Okay, so I want to just emphasize one last time that I haven't tried to convince you that any of this is correct about Esther, just that it's plausible about Esther. And therefore, the point is that any reader ought to be looking at Esther and being like, I'm uncomfortable. I really need to think harder about this. Like, maybe I read wrong. Maybe I need to think about, maybe the author's trying to say something else. Maybe there's something else going on. Maybe it's deeper, more profound. Or maybe not, in which case I really don't like this book. Or I love this book because I love being subversive. I don't know. I guess you could decide what you like. But the point here up to now has really not been to try to argue what the book means, but some of the impressions it must have left as potential significances on its early readers, and things that, as we'll continue to see, readers struggled with immediately and have continued to struggle with.
It also explains why Chazal were so hesitant to put it in Tanakh.
I think that's right.
And Esther had to push hard. It actually incorporates a lot of Chazal, I think, what you're saying.
I think you're right.
Okay, we'll pick that up in future weeks.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Greatly appreciate
it. Thank you all.
Seeing you. 1 p.m., you have a few hour break to have lots of coffee or whatever. 1 p.m., Alex Israel is back with his series on Eliyahu. That will be at 1 p.m. Tomorrow, as I mentioned, we have two new classes at 11 a.m. Dr. Menachem Kellner on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam on the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. He's an expert on the Rambam. It's a quite a, you know, interesting what's going on today about race and all that kind of stuff. I think it's very contemporary. And there's actually why he's giving the course, because of certain things, I think, going on in the community. So that's where Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Rambam, Menachem Kellner, from Israel, he made Aliyah many, many years ago. And then at 2 p.m., as I mentioned earlier, Mark Shapiro will be interviewing Rafi Al-Maleh, who's in Morocco. That's we're going to start Jewish communities around the world for now, a five-part series. Some of the places we at Torah in Motion have visited in the past with Mark Shapiro leading the tours and the local people on the ground. So that's at 2 p.m. tomorrow. And then that's 11 and 2. And then, of course, 8 o'clock, Dr. Sokolow gives his regular weekly class share on putting together of Tanakh, which now we are doing through the commentaries, the medieval commentaries, going through that. That's more at 8 p.m. Thursday morning, Malka Simkowitz at 10:30, the Jews of ancient Egypt, not of ancient Persia. We're going back even further in history. And then Shuli Mishkin, even further in history, or not actually a little later, biblical archaeology. That's at 12 noon. And then at 8:30, Leah Sarna this week will be giving the Parshat HaShavua shir. And then my shir on the Seder, 9 a.m. Friday morning. And Sunday morning, Menachem Liptag at 11:15, who told me at the end of class that he has a totally different reading of Megillat Esther than Dr. Kohler has. Baruch Hashem. Eilu ve'eilu. So that's 11:15. On Sunday.
Not only that, he's going to be source material later in our class.
I'm sorry, he's going to be what?
Source material.
Beseder, great. And then Monday, we might as well go through the whole week. Monday morning at 11 a.m., Dr. Reva Lindsay Guhartz on the Jews in Islam, which you should know about Islam. And then Mark Shapiro, 8:30 p.m., the rise of Reform Judaism and the traditional responses to reform. Got lots to keep you busy and your friends busy. Please invite them to join us. And everybody have a wonderful day. We look forward to seeing you soon. Dr. Kohler, we look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you very much. And everybody, thank you very much. Be well. Okay, bye-bye. Yes.